Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
This is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. I'm your host, Hillary Kerr, and today I am delighted to share we're doing a special bonus episode called Good Talks with Jenna Banz, the creator of the new NBC show, Good Girls. It's basically a crime drama, plus there's a lot of comedy, and it comes from a place of female empowerment, so I was super excited to watch it, especially knowing Jenna's background. Prior to creating Good Girls, Jenna worked on a number of Shonda Rhimes shows, and now she is striking out on her own. I'm so excited to sit down with you today, Jenna. Welcome to Second Life.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm really excited to do this, too, in part because I've seen the show.
Yes.
I really love it.
I'm so glad.
We're going to talk about
it. It would be so awkward if you didn't.
No, it's amazing. So we're going to talk about that. But first, I wanted to give our listeners a little bit of background about you and how you got to this place and how you got to where you are today. But first things first, when did you know you wanted to write for TV?
Well, here's the funny thing. So I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota, a place that I still totally consider home, but it's also a place where it doesn't occur to you. It's not like growing up in Hollywood or LA. It does not occur to you that there are any viable careers to be had in entertainment. My parents, they're both lawyers. They're lovely people. They were like, you're going to law school, right? When I first started getting into theater, and then I was a theater major in college and started writing plays. And they were all like, this is an amazing hobby. It's like they were so supportive of it as a hobby. But they kept saying, you're going to law school, right? And so I moved to New York. I was still writing plays. No one was coming to see them. They were these like tiny black box theaters, like the cliche you can just picture right away.
Wait, so how old are you?
I'm like 22.
You're fresh 22.
Fresh out of college.
And you're like, I'm just going to go write plays in
totally.
New York.
Well, I went to Northwestern in Chicago, which has an amazing theater school. So I was surrounded by a lot of friends who also thought doing the same thing was a totally normal thing to do. So it wasn't like I was so brave and by myself. I went with a bunch of friends and it was super fun and we were
really
poor.
You're 22 and you're creating and producing and performing your own work?
Yes. Again, you make it sound really good. Again, you know, in these tiny theaters where like three people would come and we would be like, you know,
elated.
Call it a performance and be elated by it and be on a high after. But ultimately, I was slinging margaritas and serving burritos on the Upper West Side. And, you know, my parents kept saying, when are you going to go to law school? So I finally applied to law school because I, you know, you get older and you're like, I don't want to be serving margaritas forever. So I applied, and it was around that time I met my now husband, Justin Spitzer, who's also a television writer. And he was like, why are you trying to write plays? Like, writing for TV is so much more viable and easier. And just come to Hollywood and defer law school. So I did. And I kept deferring. I think I deferred. I got into a law school and then deferred for 4 years.
No.
Because I just couldn't. I was scared. I just couldn't pull the trigger on going, this is what I'm going to do. And now I look back and laugh because all of that fear, you know, was just so just unfounded and misplaced. And anyway.
But it was a safety net.
It was a safety net. And coming from Minnesota and coming from these very practical parents, I felt like I needed a safety net. And so here I am. That's how I got here.
On a side note, I have a parallel journey in the sense that, so I was a journalism major and worked at Elle Magazine when I first started my career. But the reason I did that was because it was hard for me to go to my parents and say, Mom, Dad, I'm going to be a novelist.
Totally.
But I thought, like, what is the way I want to be a writer?
Right.
How can I write, but in a way that seemed more practical?
Right.
And then all of a sudden I thought, well, magazines are like a thing that people read.
Totally legit. People buy those.
That seems like a much more reasonable way that sort of like
you know, being a novelist was being a playwright, right. and then the actual work was being a journalist.
Yeah,
I was like, okay, I totally get that.
Yeah.
So I feel you on that, where you're like, I'm still doing the thing, just in a slightly
totally. And I did it in stages. You know, I didn't rip off the Band-Aid and go, I'm moving to Hollywood. You know, goodbye, Practical Life. I sort of did it in baby steps. And
so, were there TV shows that you loved growing up, or TV shows that you were obsessed with? Like, were you a big TV watcher?
Huge, okay. Huge. So much TV, so much. And now that I have kids, it appalls me a little bit about, you know,
Different times.
It really was. There was no sunscreen. I'm covered in
freckles. There were lap belts when I was a kid. Like, you didn't even have like a full seatbelt.
I know. It really, I don't think we were even in car seats. Like, I remember rolling around in the back of my parents' station wagon, and that was totally acceptable. But yeah, tons of TV. I would come home from school and watch, park myself on the floor, you know, against our couch, and just start watching soaps with, we had nannies because my parents both worked, and with our babysitters after school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I would watch.
Like a Young and the Restless situation? Like
Young and the Restless. I would watch Days of Our Lives. I would watch, I think All My Children was still on at 3, like right after school. I can remember. And then I would just cruise right in, like make the afternoon just sort of meld into the evening and get into the 7 o'clock, The Family Ties. I loved Moonlighting is probably the biggest influence, the Bruce Willis, Cybill Shepherd show.
So Jenna, you're pretty much saying that you were like an early binge TV
situation. Yeah, I was like, before it was a term at the tender age of, you know, 9 or whatever, I was a binge TV watcher. I would actually do my homework in front of the TV, which my parents also, they're going to kill me when they listen to this, but they also found totally acceptable. Like, I would spread out my homework and just do it in front of the TV during commercial breaks.
As long as it gets done,
right?
Right. So you love TV. You decided to go into it. What were some of the first things that you started working on, and how did you find it? Like, how does one start as a TV writer?
Well, what was weird is that, so my husband and I both arrived here not knowing anyone, you know, not having any sort of contacts whatsoever. And someone I went to college with was an assistant at an agency. So that was my first job out here, which was sort of a weird education, like a very quick education in how TV works, at least the business side of it, which actually turned out to be very helpful. So I was assisting this agent, a lit agent, and sending out his client scripts, but secretly trying to get my scripts into the hands of agents while I was there and trying to be wily about it. And the first show I landed on, I did a program called the Warner Brothers Writers Workshop, which is a program that kind of helps staff you. They give a financial incentive to Warner Brothers shows to staff these people from their programs.
Got it.
And I was so excited, and I got my first job, and it was canceled before we ever aired. So I think
fun.
So I think I worked for 6 weeks total.
Living the dream.
Total the dream. And I had just finished telling everybody that I got this job. I'm like, parents, especially my very practical Midwest parents, I was like, you guys, I made it.
It's all happening.
It's all happening. And then 5 minutes later, had to call them back and was like, they pulled the plug. They don't think it's a show. So
welcome
there was
Hollywood.
That. Welcome to Hollywood. But the beautiful thing was, which I didn't realize, is that you get paid as a writer. You have these contracts. So even though the plug was pulled, it was more money than I mean, I had been waiting tables. I had been, you know, doing my time as an assistant and making very little. So it was still more money that I was making, you know, for not working than I had ever made in my life. So that was the upside to it.
Okay, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And then what happened from there?
So from there, my first real job was on season one of Desperate Housewives, which was so lucky. And so many young writers asked me, like,
that was like very cultural zeitgeist.
Totally.
I don't think, I remember it was everywhere.
And I think I always laugh with other writers, just given the state of television these days and the ratings, because I think like the first episode, like 40 million people watched or something like that. It was some crazy number. And of course, it was like my first real legit job. So I thought that was normal. So there's nowhere to go but down after that.
Cool expectations.
Yeah. But it was so fun. I mean, we shot here on the Universal lot, and we wrote on the Universal lot, and we could take these little go-karts up to set and see, you know, Felicity Huffman and Eva Longoria. And it was just, it blew my mind. I was 27 years old. It was like, I really was living the dream every day. And it was a hit. So I had a job for the foreseeable future, which is always the biggest challenge.
So you went from Desperate Housewives to
to Shondaland. So I stayed for about 3 years on Housewives, and then I went to Shonda was doing a spinoff of Grey's called Private Practice, which ran for some years, and I did a year on that, and then I moved to Grey's for a few more years, and then I actually developed a show with Shonda called Off the Map, and I did that for a season, and then it got canceled, and then I went to Scandal when she started that, and yeah, she has this amazing ability to bring together just a stable of writers that all really like each other and work really well together. So it's very fun. Like, once I was sort of in that family, I had no desire to leave.
I was going to say, so, like, what kinds of stuff did you learn from her, too? Because I think about, like, the women who were my bosses in the beginning and who really sort of shepherded my career. When we started our company, I often would think to myself, well, what would Rachel do in this situation? Like, how would she handle it? Because all of a sudden, too, I had this being a boss is so different, no matter how great of an employee you think you are or in fact are. Being a boss is such a different feel. So I'm just curious, like, what are the sorts of things that you learn from Shonda that you probably take with you on a daily basis?
I mean, so much. I would say the most important thing is just to sort of run your show with a sense of fearlessness, because I clearly, given, you know, my story of how I started, operate from a base of fear and caution and practicality. And, you know, she is someone that, whether it's storytelling, she's sort of fearless in her storytelling. You know, I can't tell you how many times she would come in the room and be like, you know, this is going to happen. And 9 writers would look at her and be like, that's crazy. And then it ended up, but she was so set in her, you know, so true to her convictions, we'd do it. And then it would be the thing people were talking about. I remember she said, this is one of my favorite stories about Shonda. She said when she was doing the Scandal pilot, someone gave her the note of, can't Olivia, Kerry Washington, and Tony Goldwyn just be good friends? It's like a little weird that they had an affair. And there was like 10 minutes of silence on the phone. And she was like, no, this is a show in which he is going to bend her over the desk in the Oval Office and have his way with her. That's the show. And she was so, you know, she just stayed true to that. And can you imagine Scandal without that relationship at its core? Of course, no. So I think, you know, just to carry that sense of fearlessness into storytelling, into the way I deal with and manage people, because I'm also someone who really shies away from conflict. I mean, if there's a lot of being a boss is telling people, you know, how they can be doing a better job. And I could not hate that more. I just want them to do a better job without having to communicate it. I'm sure you know, I mean, you must deal with that all the time. And it's really hard. It's uncomfortable.
No one teaches you how to be a boss.
No.
Or how to manage. No. I mean, like, I realize there are, like, management schools, but I was a That's British different. Literature major.
Totally.
Like, there's
totally.
No
I was
any
theater.
Of that.
We were not learning any of that.
No practical schools. No. So how do you deal with some of that stuff? Like, how have you pushed yourself to be a better boss?
I mean, I'm constantly learning. I could lie and say I'm really good at it, and I'm still not. You know, I would say each example that comes up, I sort of try to think after how I can do better next time, how I dealt with that, you know, in what ways I succeeded, in what ways I did not. And it's always a mix of both. You know, sometimes I communicate really effectively. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'll go, God, I really got to tell, you know, this props person, by the way, our props person's amazing. This is just an example, but this props person that he's not stepping up, and I'll make that mental note to myself, and then I'll put it off so long that some giant mistake will happen and I have to deal with it, you know, on a much bigger scale than if I had just attacked
it early.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm constantly sort of battling with myself and trying to be better at that. But you know, it's a struggle. It's probably the biggest challenge I face day to day.
Do you have a different management style for women versus men, or for different, like, how old someone is? It's something too where I'm always trying to personally tweak, where it's like or just on a person to person basis, because I find oftentimes, like, millennials want to be dealt with in a different way than
that's tricky too.
Z or Gen X, and trying to figure out, like, okay, this is what the feedback loop needs to look like, or
right.
these people like to be told, or this person likes to be told in a very straightforward way, this person needs carrot to go along with it. Like,
yeah, I mean, yes. And, you know, I think that's easier when you really know everybody that's working for you. And this show is a particular challenge because our production is in Atlanta. We write in LA. So I feel like with the core group of writers I have in LA, I know them really, really well at this point. And I feel like I can pull any one of them aside and say, listen, you're doing this amazing. Can you do this a little better? And sort of know how to tailor that to each person. But, you know, when it comes to these people that are really just voices on the phone, it's a little trickier. But I have been thinking a lot this season about the generation thing and how millennials sort of take criticism differently than, you know, people my age. And yeah, it's tricky. And everybody's different too. So just when you think you can make like these vast generalizations, you can't. So I would say, you know, I just need to sort of just be blunt about things. I just need to attack things head on and not put them off because I'm scared of conflict is the biggest lesson to learn.
Got it. I appreciate
and
that.
And I think people appreciate it too, is the irony, is like,
they just want answers.
They just want answers and they want to be told what they're doing well and where they can improve. They'd rather be told that than like you pull the rug out from under them weeks later.
Completely.
But it's hard to tell yourself that when it's such an uncomfortable conversation to be had.
Completely. So how did you know that it was time to go out on your own? Because, you know, I think there's one, being a part of a team and being essentially an entrepreneur, which is what you're doing right now, and like starting something on your own.
Right.
That you are leading the charge on. It's a very different mentality, and you can be really good at one and not great at the other, or great at one, back and forth. How did you know now is the time, this is the show,
yeah.
I'm ready to go?
Well, it's funny.
So I want to do my own thing.
Totally. When I created that show with Shonda mm-hmm. called Off the Map, I remember it was this very interesting dynamic where when all the press for the show came out, for better or for worse, we got some good reviews, we got some bad reviews, but it all basically said it was a Shonda Rhimes show because she is such an amazing, you know, giant in the room. She's a giant producer of television and I was just a writer. But I remember thinking like, man, if I'm going to work this hard again, like I kind of want to fail on my own terms. I kind of want to fail or succeed, hopefully succeed, but with my own name attached to it. And I had a very frank conversation with her about that when I was sort of forging off going like, because we love working together and we collaborate really well together. And she was like, why don't you stay and we can do a show together? And I was like, I would love to, but I kind of want it to be a Jenna Van show, not another Shonda Rhimes show. And to her credit, she was like, I totally get it. Like, because she's the biggest boss of them all. She totally, totally understood that. So, you know, I guess it was, for lack of a better word, like kind of just ego driven. Like, if I'm going to kill myself and work every weekend and think about the show night and day and not see my kids, I sort of want to get credit for it at the end of the day.
I understand that. And that's sort of the interesting thing, too, about being an entrepreneur or doing your own thing that I don't think people always realize is that there's no off button.
Right. That's so true.
There's no, that's not my job.
Right.
It's always on all the time. Mm-hmm. You can't turn your brain off. It doesn't matter that it's the weekend. It
true.
Doesn't matter that it's after hours. Mm-hmm. Like if there's a problem, you get the call. If there's, your brain also just doesn't turn off.
No.
So.
And I think it comes from a place of caring about it.
100%.
It's like your child, you know, and we both have children, but it's like, it's another child that you're constantly thinking about and nurturing and hoping will turn out okay. So it's, yeah, you can't turn your brain off and you don't want to in
no.
a way because you're so invested. So it kind of makes all the highs higher and the lows lower.
So having your own show, I feel like there's a lot of problem solving that comes along with it. But something even bigger that I personally am always curious about is how people get past, how they move forward when they're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So like when you have writer's block or there's a problem that you just don't know how to get through, what do you do?
Well, the good news is when you have a show, you have nine other really, really smart writers to help you. So you can always pull one of them in and go, I just can't figure this out. Can you do a version of it? Because sometimes I think a lot of writers are like this, I can see a scene and see what's wrong with it, but staring at that blank page is just so intimidating. So luckily I have a host of amazingly talented people who can go like, what about this? Let's throw something against the wall. I'm also married. to someone who does the exact same thing. So I can't tell you how much of our dinner time conversations when we're home for dinner are spent working out problems on each other's shows all the time. Like, so much so that it's kind of a problem. Like, we'll have a date night. We'll finally have a babysitter and we'll go out for drinks and food
and you or talk whatever. Shop?
Yeah. Like, it's so hard not to. We talk shop all the time. Like, he has a problem with the story. I have a problem with the story.
But that's amazing that you have a sounding board and someone who you trust their opinions and taste and all of that, because that is not a given in any relationship, whether it's a friendship or a marriage or whatever
it's so funny. It's fraught too, though. We wrote a movie together at one point, and I just remember there's so many tears involved because, like, every note he'd give me, I'd take so personally because I'm like, you're supposed to love me. You have to think I'm so good at this. Like, so that's the downside, is that there's a lot of tears and a lot of fighting. But but yes, it is amazing to have a sounding board and to live with someone who does the same thing you do. And
God, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so cancellation and failure is a huge part of the TV and entertainment world.
Totally.
I know, obviously, it's happened to you. Mm-hmm. What are some of the main things that you've learned by something getting canceled or something not working out the way that you want it to? And how do you sort of, like, pick yourself up and press forward?
Well, at the time, I mean, speaking for me, I feel like I can't press on. It feels so personal. And I think any writer, I mean, maybe I'll get to a point where I'm so seasoned that it's like just another notch on the belt and I can just roll out of bed and go do something else. But I remember even coming up with the idea for Good Girls, I was talking to my mom and I was like, ugh, I just had a show canceled. I had the show on ABC a couple years ago. And I was like, what am I going to do now? You know, so dramatic. Like, I have nothing else in me. And she was like,
I have no stories to tell.
I have no stories to tell. And she was like, do something funnier. Like, my last show was really dark. So she was like, do something funnier. She's very practical. But yeah, I mean, it's crushing. It's totally crushing. But as you say, it's completely part of the job. And odds are you're going to face it more than once. And I don't know. You just take time to mourn it, I guess I would say. I mean, I think.
Like a relationship?
Kind of. Yeah. Like a little bit of a death. Like a
you creative
got dumped. Death. Like you got dumped hard. Like you got dumped by America.
In high school.
Yeah.
When the feelings
in front of everybody.
Oh, God. At lunch.
By the country at lunch in the cafeteria. That's what it is. No one wanted to watch what you were putting on screen. But yeah, and then you get over it, and then you get excited by another idea, and, you know.
Where do you get your ideas? Where does inspiration come from? Like, where did Good Girls come from?
Good Girls came out of that before reference conversation with my mom, who was like, it was in the height of the election. It was Hillary versus Trump, and I think the Access Hollywood tape had just come out, and I was saying to my mom, I can't believe, because I think now looking back on it, it was more naivete than anything. But I said to her in this moment, like, I can't believe people are that overtly sexist. And there was a long pause and she was just like, where have you been? Because she's, you know, salty and 70 in Minnesota. And she was so crushed about Hillary's loss. So crushed. And they kind of spawned from there. Just this sort of desire to do something fun and uplifting. And it's funny, the female empowerment angle sort of came secondary to just writing something entertaining and fun and taking people's minds off of what was going on was sort of the goal.
So one of the central, in my opinion, sort of themes and the heart of Good Girls is sort of this idea of risk and what makes you, what pushes you to risk, what makes you decide to take a leap and make some sort of like bold move. Where did that come from and what pushes you in that direction?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think
to go outside your comfort zone.
Totally. I mean, yes, I think this entire career is so far out of my comfort zone. Like there's a definitely there's a version of myself
sliding
in another
doors.
Dimension, sliding doors, like just very happy as a lawyer in Minnesota.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah,
though?
I think, and sometimes
like the safe
I think
route?
It's true. Yeah, is the safe route so bad? I don't know. It's something I think about a lot and struggle with. But yes, I think these women in this show are, you know, they're sort of pushed in between a rock and a hard place. And they are financially, they're struggling. Emotionally, they're struggling for all different varied reasons. And I think they're at the point in their lives where they've woken up and realized they've made the safe choice for so long and it hasn't gotten them anywhere. They're a little bit like, what do I have to lose? So I think that's something we can all sort of apply to our own lives. I mean, I know I definitely can. And whether it's career choice or whether it's relationships or, you know, just being brave and fearless about things is so important. I don't think anyone's ever regretted doing that. And it's something, by the way, not to sound like a wise sage, like I have to tell myself that every single day because it is so much easier to make the safer choice. But I think we do more exciting things when we don't.
How do you push yourself, though, to make that brave choice? So, for example, I often find it easier to imagine that I'm making it on someone else's behalf because I think that women are not always our own best advocates, but we are amazing advocates for our friends, for our loved ones. But the same way that if a girlfriend of mine is dating a guy who's a jerk, I am the one who is like, you deserve better and you could do so much better and you should stand up for yourself and not let him do this and blah, blah, blah. But then if it was me, I was like, no, it's okay. Like, it's fine that he's 2 hours late for dinner. No, he's busy. It's not a big deal. But if all of a sudden I start thinking about it from the point of view of, would I be okay with this behavior if someone was treating my dear friend this way, then all of a sudden that can kind of snap me out of it. So that's I have to sort of, I mean, but it's also kind of sick and weird that I have to like disassociate with myself to stand up for myself.
Right.
But I have found that that is a weird trick that works for me. Do you have something like that?
You know, or? I would say the only thing is I do tell myself, you know, there's a lot of Midwest, I lead with this Midwest politeness, and that's something that just doesn't serve you very well. Or I found like it doesn't serve me very well in a being a boss in a leadership position. So there are a lot of times that I'm like, okay, I just need to tell, I have to step back and go, this person isn't getting what I'm trying to communicate and look at, is it because of the way I'm communicating? Is it because I'm trying to be so polite and not ruffle any feathers and tiptoe around them? Or should I just say, I don't like this and I want this? I mean, so much of my job is saying no or saying I want it this way. You know, you write, so much of being a television writer is like you write a car explosion and then production, the studio, whoever comes back to you and they're like, we can't afford that, but we could do like a feather lands on the ground. And like the like nice girl in me goes, okay, I can make that work.
Feathers
I, you know,
are cool.
Maybe they're right because of A, B, and C. And so I constantly have to go,
push back.
No, I want the car explosion. And here's why it's going to help the show. And here's what it's going to do for all of us. And so, yeah, I think it's just taking a step back. And especially when I get frustrated and I go home at night angry and I'm like, no, it's because you're not asking for what you want. That's why you're not getting what you want.
So my dad's from Ohio, so I always say that much like Judaism is passed down matrilineally, I feel like Midwesternism is passed down patrilineally. So
I'm
technically Midwestern, even though I grew up in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if it's a Midwest thing or if it's a female thing or if it's just a you and me thing.
Yeah.
But I too have that people-pleasy thing. How do you get past that?
I think it's maybe a female thing. I don't know.
Maybe but what it's do you not. Do? How do you not worry about it so much?
I think it might be something that gets better with age because I noticed I am worried about it less as I get older. I'm 42 now, and in my 20s, it was like, whoa. I mean, just total dancing monkey at all times. But as, yeah, exactly. What can I do for you? How can I help you? But I think maybe it's something we shake off a little bit as we age and we realize there's no time for that shit.
Do you think about that in terms of your daughters too?
Yeah. Ugh. It kills me. And I already see I have a 6-year-old daughter, 2 daughters, but the 6-year-old is already like, oh, I'm worried that blah, blah, blah doesn't like me at school. And I find myself going, don't care. Fuck them. You know, and really like it's just a little preschool disagreement that I'm infusing all of my feminist rage into. But yes, I worry about that all the time.
Set her on fire. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. You go after them. You go to preschool and you show them.
Burn it.
Show
to
the boys.
Ground.
Yeah. And it's like, my husband's always like, take it down a notch. It's not a feminist thing. Like, you don't have to make it into something it's not. But yeah, it's hard. That stuff's hard. You know, I think you just work on it. And at least you become aware. Yes. I mean, that's half the battle, right? Because I do know a lot of people who are challenged with the same sort of behaviors and are not that aware of it. So at least I sort of know when I'm doing it.
What advice would you give someone who wanted to write for TV?
Watch a ton of TV.
Okay.
Write a ton. I mean,
like spec scripts?
Spec scripts. I mean, people aren't doing spec scripts so much anymore. They're doing.
Oh, did I just date myself?
No. I mean, when I started, it was all, I had like 7 spec scripts. I wrote like a Buffy and a Shield, and like every show I was vaguely into, I would write a spec of it. But now it's all about the original sample. So it's all about having a play or a pilot or
I've seen
short stories. Yeah, like really sort of finding something that showcases your voice. And I have to say, like, it's shocking to me how many writers you meet out here that don't write. Do you know what I mean? It's crazy. That say, you know, I'm a writer, and you're like, oh, great, I'm happy to read a script or whatever, and then they don't have one, or they've been working on one for like 18 years. But I would say just having scripts for when that person, because you never know when you're going to have an opportunity to get into the right hands. And it really, you know, it's the great equalizer. Like, you don't have to know anyone out here. But if you have a fucking kick-ass script that gets into the hands of an agent or a TV executive or another writer, it can take you so, so far. And I think that's what people don't realize. You don't have to have the connections. You just have to have an amazing script. And very few people have that script that just completely stands out. So I would spend all of my time working on that if I were them.
Okay, so last question, and then I'll let you go to your incredibly busy, go about your incredibly busy life and day and job. What advice would you give your younger self, knowing everything that you know now?
Yes, just to stop fucking panicking about everything, you know, to stop like thinking everything was the most dramatic decision about to be made and just go for it. Because I just think about a lot of wasted spikes of, what's the stress hormone, like cortisol. Like, I feel like my cortisol level in my 20s must have been so sky high over nothing. I'm like, girl, wait till you have kids and there's real shit to worry about.
Do you think that sometimes we invent drama when we don't have our own?
Probably.
Because I think that there's sometimes, like, I too think about the times when I would, you know, make stress out about something like so crazy and it was such a big deal. And then looking back on it, then once we started the company, I had real problems.
Right.
Where I was like, how am I going to pay people and how am I going to do this? Then all of a sudden, those sorts of things, when a friend would come to me and she was freaking out about something, I would have to remind myself that tired is tired.
Yeah.
Pain is pain.
Yeah.
Stress is stress.
Yeah.
And if it feels stressful to you, that's real.
Totally.
My stress is bigger than yours, but my stress is my stress.
Right.
And we all feel the stress that we feel.
Yeah, I think so.
But you also have to keep it in perspective.
Yes. And not completely operate from a place of fear, because you'll never get anywhere. You know, it's miraculous I'm here with the level of panic and fear. It really is. It really is. I'm lucky. I'm very lucky. So yes, I would tell my younger self to like have a drink, like to chill out, to go be a writer if you want to be a writer. Like all that time I wasted on law school applications. I actually took a class to do okay on the LSAT. How much money was that? I could have that money right now. Like, just silly.
That's a bag.
Yeah, I guess. That is a bag. That's a nice bag. So, yeah, there's just no fear. Just try shit and see how it works out.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Jenna who have taken the leap to pursue their passion, visit mydomain.com. We have a whole series of Second Life stories for you to peruse. We also want to know who you would like to hear from, so shoot us an email at secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can direct message me on Instagram at Hillary Kerr. That's HillaryKerr. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and please don't forget to rate and review us.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.